From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, Halifax, North Carolina, 1949. A country road, weathered barns, tobacco drying on rafters in late afternoon light, rusted pickups at a roadside bar, and a hand-painted sign that decrees no niggers, no Jews, no dogs. Actor and playwright John Henry Redwood remembers a sign like that from one of his own youthful days in the 1960s, a statement of vicious exclusion and indignity that stayed with Redwood, eventually becoming the title of his latest stage drama of one family's life in the Jim Crow South and its intersection with the life of one Jew in the midst of his own struggle with identity in America. Tonight we meet the Cheeks family. Like many families, they're bound together by affection, faith, and the struggle to survive. But their decisions and relationships with each other and with Yevhenny Aronson are stamped with the bigotry and limited choices of their time, a time in the not-so-distant American memory. Tonight on Point, a drama of love and loss, of bonds broken and forged in America, John Henry Redwood's No Niggers, No Jews, No Dogs. Joining me now from Norfolk, Virginia, is the actor and playwright John Henry Redwood. Good evening and welcome, John Henry Redwood.
Good evening. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also with me in the studio is Adam Zoller, who's directing a new production of the play at the New Repertory Theater in Newton, Massachusetts. Good evening and welcome, Adam Zoller.
Thank you.
And with us in the studio, the cast of No Niggers, No Jews, No Dogs, Baron Kelly, Jacqueline Gregg, Giselle Jones, Natanja Driscoll, and Ted Kazanoff. We'll hear from all of them tonight, but I just want to acknowledge that they're all standing with us here at the microphones, and we're honored to have you all along. John Henry Redwood, in Virginia tonight. It's a tough story you've written, but you've written it in a very traditional kind of dramatic form, and given it a title that's gotten an awful lot of attention right out of the gate, and is fairly brutal to repeat on air. I understand you've even were pressured at one point to change the title of the play. Why?
Well, I wasn't really pressured. I was asked to because, again, the same thing, I think, for financial reasons, and it was hard to have the play advertised, and a lot of newspapers didn't want to print a title or felt that there would be some problems with printing the title, so the theaters felt that they would have problems in advertising. However, all of that fell to the wayside when we got approval from the Philadelphia branch of the NAACP mm-hmm. and the black clergy of Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Tribune, which is the black newspaper there, and a couple of other organizations, including a Jewish organization. And so all of that fell by the wayside. It was just a matter of coming up with some sort of creative advertising to circumvent those folks that felt threatened by the title.
John Henry Redwood, you grew up in Brooklyn with
right.
Jewish friends,
yes.
best friends, but spent summers in the South. And as I read this play, it sounds very much like the meeting of those experiences being expressed here. Would you be good enough for people who haven't seen it yet to give us the kind of nutshell summary of what goes on so we can understand the conversation and the bits of the play that we're going to hear as we go ahead?
Well, what goes on in the play is two things are happening. You have the untold story of what happens to what happened to black women in the South during that period of time, and how easy and it was to do that with impunity for white males, and how a black male was almost helpless to defend his woman as much as he wanted to, and the woman, of course, wanting to keep her husband alive, probably in most cases would not even mention the fact that something like this would happen to her. So knowing he would be lynched if he tried to avenge that.
And we're talking here the rape of black women in the South, which is central to the story.
Absolutely.
Of your play.
Absolutely. And then in the mix, of course, is Yevhenny, the Jewish scholar who has somewhere along the line lost his identity, and he's trying to come back to his roots now, and he finds the courage to, one of the things he has to do is tell his story about how this has happened. He's never had the opportunity to tell this story, and he has the opportunity to tell it, given what's going on in this play, the courage he picks up from Maddie, and that allows him to be able to stand up and tell the story and face his demons.
We're going to hear from the play tonight, and I think it might be best if we begin to plunge in so people, listeners, can begin to get a feeling for the flavor of the play. Set in 1949 in Halifax, North Carolina. The setting is, it sounds like, I don't know, countryside, near a town perhaps, where the Cheeks family lives. Maddie is the mother. Rawl is the father. They are, I guess, John Henry Redwood, it sounds like they're working on the land as sharecroppers or something like that of the white farmer who lives nearby. Into this setting comes Yavani, a Jewish scholar who's doing research on, as I read it, on oppressed people. He sees his own people as one. He sees the black community that he's come into, this black family that he's come into as one. Maybe we'll start with a scene, and here we have Baron Kelly as Rawl Cheeks and Ted Kazanoff as Yavani Aronson, well, sitting on the porch.
Take the chest up with you so you can practice. We'll see how much better you are when you get back.
No, that digging, I think I'll be too tired to have my mind on any chest.
How long you be gone?
A month or two, maybe three. Depends on how many graves have to be dug up and how many men they have to deal with.
Well, it doesn't sound like a job I would like to do.
Even my brother James will be there.
Oh, will he?
Sure enough. He heard how good they was paying for digging up them dead white folks and decided to come on down from Cleveland and get some of that money.
Well, when you see him, give him my thanks for putting in a good word for me with you and Maddie. I don't know where to start to find a family like yours for my research.
How's that coming?
I'm beginning work on a chapter about the negative psychological effects of signs.
Signs?
Oh, yeah, you know, no colored allowed, no Jews.
I've seen them all my life, but I ain't never seen nothing against no Jews.
Oh, they're there.
So there are other people beside us colors these crackers don't like?
Yes, my friend, there are.
Yeah, well, anyway, I'm going to thank James for all that money he's paying us for that research. I plan to add that to the money I'll be getting for digging up these graves and see if we can get some running water in this house. If they ever get the water line out this far, to us colored folks, would they pay me for those 3 months to take me a year to make on this place? And I'll still be back in time to bring in the peanuts and the corn. Then we want to see if we can send Joyce over to Elizabeth City State to get at least 1 year of college.
Joyce, a very smart young lady.
Yeah, smart. Stubborn, prideful, and feisty with a very bad temper. Maddie says she takes after me, not the smart part.
I can believe that. But the temper, I mean. Seeing how you manhandled my chess pieces when you lost the game. Nonetheless, it seems to me it's not a good thing digging up people from their resting place.
White people do it all the time. They call it archaeology.
Oh, yeah, but that's for scientific and educational purposes.
And that makes it right?
Joyce, now you know better than to interrupt grown folks when they're talking, don't you?
Yes, sir.
Now, don't you go thinking you grown and all just because you turned 17. You're not thinking like that, I hope.
No, sir.
I thought your mama had some business to take care with you two.
Mama says she didn't feel like whipping nobody on Sunday.
And there we have an early scene from No Niggers, No Jews, No Dogs. Read here by Baron Kelly as Rawl Cheeks, Ted Kazanoff as Yavani Aronson, and we heard the girls' voices chiming in as well, Giselle Jones as Joyce Cheeks, and Natanja Driscoll as Matoka, or Toka Cheeks. Adam Zeller, give us a sense for this. Rawl, the father in this family, is headed north, south, somewhere to do some grave digging in white cemeteries to make some extra money. At the same time, Yavani's come into the world. Give us a sense of this scene and talk to us about how, of all the plays that are out there to do in the year 2003, how you decided to choose this one.
First of all, I didn't choose it myself. This was chosen by Rick Lombardo, who's the producing artistic director at the theater. And he chose it, I think really for two reasons. One is it's a story about a family at a critical moment in their lives together. A moment of great pain and great difficulty in how they deal with it. So it's a very, very human story. But at the same time, it's also about a time in our history that I think that we're still working through and still trying to understand and still trying to get come to grips with today. And it reflects some on our lives today and our society today. And I think that's why it was chosen.
But, of course, it's unique in a sense in that it's not just the story of a black family doing this, but woven through is the thread of the Jewish other, the Jewish visitor who's there as well. How does that figure in?
Well, I think there's a historical connection between the two. And it also broadens the issues. It's so often that we look at the issues of race or the issues of discrimination being localized to one group and forget that those issues are spread out to other groups, that it's not a single group all the time. Yes, some people are more severely targeted than others.
John Henry Edward, let me ask you about that same theme here. You know, over the decades, black-Jewish relations have gone through ups and downs and cycles. There was tremendous cooperation during the Civil Rights Movement, but then, you know, in the 80s, we had Jesse Jackson in the 1988 presidential campaign, the whole flap over Hymietown. The Crown Heights story from the 90s, which as a Brooklyn boy, I'm sure you know well. What was it for you in the late 90s that brought this juncture of these two groups to the fore in your mind as the meat for your attention?
Well, it's been my experience, as you had mentioned earlier, that I had grown up in a predominantly Jewish neighborhood, and the things I relate in the really the positive things I relate in the play are things that have really actually happened. My good friend used to come up. I lived on the sixth floor. They lived on the first floor, and they would come upstairs before school so they could eat my mother's bacon and little stuff like that because they weren't allowed to, and I was considered a Shabbos goy. And so what happens is of all the other ethnic groups outside of the African-American, myself being an African-American, the Jewish culture is one that I understand more than any other. And I'm very close to it in the sense that I've grown up in it. I have seen it, coexisted with it. And so I feel a sense of camaraderie in terms of how we both as ethnic groups have gone through varying stages of discrimination. The problem being is that in terms of the African American community, when we started, it's very telling to know what happens to a group of people when they're devoid of their culture. And the difference I feel is that, you know, even though there's discrimination in the Jewish community, they were able to maintain their culture. They still have a language. They still have their music. They still have their religion. Whereas African Americans, we don't have that.
An awful lot of music, an awful lot of culture
that we have created out of what we were given, not the, mm-hmm. Not our original culture mm-hmm. that came over from the motherland, from Africa. We were not remnants of that come through in our music and our jazz and our blues and our spirituals, probably even in our dance. The creativity that it will allow us to come up with to create jazz. I mean, jazz is something that is not written. You can't write notes for it. In terms of the keys and this key structure that's being played and all of these different type of things that have come through, those are still remnants. However, we did not, you know, our language is English, and that is not our original language. And so what we also have to remember is there's a difference between having come here and having been brought here.
We're talking tonight with playwright John Henry Redwood about his latest play, No Niggers, No Jews, No Dogs. The cast is in the studio. We'll hear more of the play after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Mm-hmm. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the latest drama from John Henry Redwood, the brutally named but affecting No Niggers, No Jews, No Dogs. It's been performed across the country and opening in the Boston area tonight. Let's hear another scene from this drama set in the Jim Crow South, 1949, in Halifax, North Carolina, where the Cheeks family is dealing with the latter days of harsh discrimination. In this scene, which we're going to hear read by Baron Kelly and Jacqueline Gregg, the father, Rawl Cheeks, is about to set off to make some extra money digging in graveyards, and we hear the husband and the wife discussing their life and that departure.
Why are you getting like this?
Maybe it has something to do with sleeping in our bed all by myself for the next 2 or 3 months.
You know where I'm going.
We can make do without my daughter's father going off to dig up some dead white folks. We got enough trouble with them living ones running around up here without you having to go dig up those that have already been gotten rid of.
Make do. Me farming somebody else's land, you wash white folks' clothes.
And we make do.
Is that we gonna tell Joyce when we don't have the money for her to go to Elizabeth City State? And what happens when it's Toke's turn to go to college? How many of Joe Flood's white shirts you gonna have to wash and iron to send her? Or are they gonna have to stand over that pot and stir Joe Flood's son's shirts? You know, don't nobody, colored or white, like that old Poe Buckra no ways. If you let us move up to Cleveland, you wouldn't have to be washing no shirts, and I wouldn't have to be farming and plowing, and the girls wouldn't have to be missing school so they could pick cotton and pull tobacco. Now, James will help us get started. He's doing right nice.
How right nice can James be doing if he's gone all the way down to Alabama to help you dig up some dead white folks?
Him and me can start working on our plans to start fixing cars together, and you wouldn't have to be washing no white man's shirts.
What's the matter? White men don't wear shirts in Cleveland?
While I'm away, I want you to think about Cleveland.
Rawl, we've gone into this, Lord knows, I don't know how many times, and I keep telling you, I don't want to leave Halifax.
But what were you believing? What?
This is where I was born. I can walk less than a mile and see my people.
Well, you can see their graves, that's all you see.
And that's enough for me. Who's going to take care of Aunt Cora? I can't leave her. Who's going to feed her?
Now, we don't have to live up there until we die. Now, maybe just till the girls get grown. There are more chances for them up there. We can always come back to Halifax. But look at Miss Elizabeth and Miss Quilly. They lived up there in Harlem for almost 35 years, then they moved back here.
They moved back here to die.
I'm dying here, Maddie. I don't know if I can stay here much longer, cowtowing to these crackers.
Baron Kelly and Jacqueline Gregg as Maddie and Rawl Cheeks, reading from John Henry Redwood's No Niggers, No Jews, No Dogs. John Henry Redwood set us in this 1949 setting as you imagine it. We can feel the tensions here, the pull of the North for this black family, the limited economic opportunities that they're facing there, the tension that that brings into this marriage.
Well, yes. What happens is black women always. Well, first of all, my philosophy is in terms of my history and my philosophy about us is that we have survived. African Americans have survived on this continent because of the strength and perseverance of black women, and that's why I write a lot about black women. Is because black women, if we don't tell their story, then we're really remiss in telling our history overall. And in this particular case, I used to hear my mother and my grandmother, both of my grandmothers and all from North Carolina, and they would speak of the things that black women had to do to assure that the men, the boys, myself, and that time a boy, grew up to be a man, because there's a possibility that, you know, they would take somebody out at 14 years old, like Emmett Till, and kill him for no reason. Mm-hmm. And so black women always had to be one step ahead of a black man to keep him from exposing himself to the dangers of the Jim Crow South. Mm-hmm. And on a couple of occasions, if you have an opportunity to read Leon Litwack's book, Trouble in Mind, there are instances where it is mentioned in there how black women had been lynched themselves for just that same thing, trying to protect their men.
And your play here turns on that very dynamic when the father, Rawl Cheeks, goes off for several months to bring back some cash. While he's gone, his wife, the girl's mother, Maddie Cheeks, is raped by the character Joe Flood, the white landowner, farmer. And then the requirement for Maddie to stay way ahead of events becomes absolutely enormous.
Right.
The pressures on her, on the family, ultimately there's... Well, let's hear. Maybe we should hear another scene.
It's almost generational.
Generational in what sense?
Well, it happened to Ancora.
Yes, Ancora is kind of the character floating through the bit of the mysterious older aunt,
right.
who had also suffered rape at the hands of a white man who told her husband he took vengeance into his own hands and paid for it with his life. Maddie desperately does not want that to happen to her own husband. She's determined to keep this event from Rawl Cheeks when he returns from his time away. Here she is with her daughters, the characters Maddie Cheeks, with daughters Joyce and Matoka.
Matoka, you talk too much.
I do not.
Mr. Anson don't want to know nothing about saying excuse me, no color church, and people going to the outhouse.
There ain't nothing wrong with talking about that. Everybody has to go to the outhouse. Even Mr. Anson has to go to the outhouse when he goes to church on Sunday. That's what's wrong with you. You think you never have to go, even if it ain't Sunday.
See, you flap your lips so much that you don't even listen. He told you they don't call them churches. And they don't go to the synagogue on Sundays, they go on Saturdays.
You storin'. Nobody goes to church on Saturdays.
I told you they don't call them churches.
I ain't studying you.
I know you better be studying them slop buckets before... Mama, you all right?
I'm fine. Just a little tired.
Mr. Anson was here. He said
what happened to your clothes? Why did you come through the woods?
Let me... Just sit here, peace.
Do you want to go inside and lay down?
I don't feel like climbing them steps right now. Just let me sit here. Matoka, baby, go start a fire on the stove and boil up some water for me, please.
Mr. Anson said he'd
go on
be
and
back.
Do what Mama told you.
You ain't nobody's mom.
Go on now, baby, please.
You want me to go to Mr. Sessom's long store and try and call Daddy, Mama?
No. Don't do that. Everything's all right. Toke?
Ma'am?
I need Aunt Cora. I want you to go and get her for me.
Mama, it's been a long time since I've been out there. I've never been out there by myself.
I'll go, Mama. Toke's always been scared, Aunt Cora.
Who you talking to scared?
Ain't no need in you being scared of your Aunt Cora, child. She ain't gonna hurt you none. She love you.
I'll go after you lay down, Mama. Go on now, Token, heat up the water.
I'm going.
Why won't you let me call Daddy, Mama?
Because there ain't nothing your daddy can do here.
Something ain't right. I ain't no child, Mama.
Toke can't hear this. Not right now. Mr. Joe Flood done... invaded my privacy.
What do you mean, Mama?
He done forced himself on me.
Mama, no. What are we gonna do?
Don't you worry none now. I'm gonna be all right.
Damn him to hell.
Joyce! Don't you ever let me hear words like that coming out of your mouth. You hear me?
I hear you, but I mean it.
You don't ever say that about another human being, no matter what.
Joe Flood ain't no human being, and I hope he burns in hell.
Don't do that, baby. Sometimes when you wish something bad on someone, you bring it on yourself. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. God will take care of Mr. Joe Flood.
Daddy will take care of Mr. Joe Flood.
Your daddy ain't got to know.
What?
We ain't gonna tell him.
Why not?
Look at what Joe Flood did to you. I don't care. We ain't gonna tell your daddy about this.
You mean to tell me you're gonna let Joe Flood force himself on you? Have his way with you and get away with it?
You're going into town to tell Sheriff Morrissey, ain't you? And just what do you think Sheriff Morrissey is going to do, Joyce? I'll tell you what. Laugh. That's right. Laugh. And what are you going to do? Nothing. Nothing? That ain't right, Mama. Right. We're colored folks living in North Carolina. It ain't right that we got to drink from a colored water fountain. Right. Don't count for us, Joyce.
And there it is in John Henry Redwood's latest play, Women Working It Out in the Jim Crow South. Jacqueline Gregg reading there as the mother, Maddie Cheeks, and the daughters, Giselle Jones's Joyce Cheeks and Natanja Driscoll as Matoka Cheeks. John Henry Redwood, take us through the dynamic here. You've designed this play to put as much weight on the backs of this woman and these girls as you could. What's the challenge for the wife and mother here?
The challenge is to try and keep, well, for the wife, is to keep her husband alive, and as well as to protect our daughters. Of course, Joyce being 17 years old and coming of age as a young woman herself, a young black woman herself in the South, there's always the cloud, as the play says, of this hanging over her head, as well as Matoka's head, as well as any other black woman down there in the South. And so Maddie's at one time trying to protect her husband, at the same time she's trying to protect herself and her family in general.
We hear in the voices of the daughters, especially Joyce, who's coming into young womanhood, mm-hmm. This is an unbroken young adult. And here she's teetering. On the one hand, trying to absorb the manner in which her mother's trying to protect her father, but at the same time, trying to protect her sense of justice.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Not understanding that justice doesn't apply. As Maddie says, it isn't right. You know, it doesn't apply for us. Right doesn't apply for us.
It's a hard, hard thing. It's not long in the play before Rawl Cheeks, the father, is home again. And we see in this next bit where Maddie, the mother, has to become unbearably obtuse to keep this whole thing from exploding. Have we ever seen where Rawl Cheeks comes back home and to find a wife who lets him know she's pregnant, but it's hard to explain?
Yeah. Well, I've been having a feeling for 3 months, and it's causing me some trouble.
Rawl, I need to talk to you before the girls get back.
Yes, Lord, and I need to talk to you, too, before the girls get back.
I'm serious, Rawl.
I said, I'm 3 months full of serious, so just come on now.
I'm pregnant.
Woo! The bread is already baking in the oven, and there ain't nothing we can do about it until it's done, so just come on.
It ain't your bread, Rawl.
Come again.
It ain't your baby.
See, you kidding, right?
I wish I was, Rawl. God knows I wish I was.
Who's this?
I don't know.
You don't what?
I mean, you don't know him.
Where is he?
I don't know.
It's his damn name. I don't know, too. Who the hell is he?
I don't have
what?
A name.
What was it, somebody passing through?
You don't know
don't
him.
Don't keep telling me that. How do you know I don't know him if I don't have a name? Now, where'd you do it? Are you going to tell me that you don't know that either?
What does it...
What? Where my daughter sleep?
No.
In our bed?
No, Rob.
Where then?
What does it matter?
I ain't going to ask you again. Where?
Where he stayed.
And see, and you let yourself go and get knocked up by him to boot. You see, I was all the time asking you to give me a son before we got too old. And see, you wouldn't do that. Now you, was it somebody at them church? All them men running around down there with them zippers open, deacon this, trustee that, Reverend Fentress. You love you some Reverend Fentress. Can't nobody say a word against him like he was God instead of God.
Reverend Ventress wouldn't do that. He's married.
Well, that didn't make you one big hell of a difference when your drawers caught fire and you got yourself knocked up.
Oh, please don't talk like that.
Don't tell me how the hell to talk.
And the circumstances are circumstances. Hard to bear. John Henry Redwood, you just have the crowbar of harsh circumstance right in the middle of this family now.
And it's a reality. Oh, it was a reality, I like to say, and hopefully it'll continue to be past tense.
You see it as the kind of tension that's not unique to the family in your drama, but you're saying a reality across that region at that time.
Oh, yes. I've sat at the foot of my grandmother and my great-grandmother and my times in Halifax, North Carolina, and Goldsboro, North Carolina, and Wilmington, North Carolina, and heard these stories constantly.
Early in the play, you have Yavani and Baron playing chess. If we think of the play as a chessboard at this point, it's just in an unbearable configuration of pieces here.
Oh, okay.
The family flies apart.
But Maddie never gives up hope in trying to keep her family together, including the unborn baby.
Which she holds on to, and there's a great debate about that. And meanwhile, the spies here that makes this that sets this apart is that the Jewish character in the play is actually woven through all of this. He's watching. He's listening. He knows what the father in the family himself does not know. But at some point, Maddie says to him, "You know, you've been down here with my family for 2 months. We'll still be down here when you're gone, and you'll go back to being white." He says, "I'm not white, Maddie. I'm Jewish." She challenges that. She says, when you drink from the water fountain, what fountain do you drink from? He says, it's not the point. Have you ever called a colored person a nigger, Mr. Aronson? And he does not answer. There's a lot of tension in being the Jewish character in the middle of this harsh drama.
Yeah.
Adam Zoller, are you expecting that people are going to know how to process that tension? The audience.
Oh, I absolutely think they do know how to process it because they see it as what it is, as people talking and people trying to work out the issues that are right there in front of them. John Henry's play very nicely shows us characters who have attachments to each other. So they have reasons for working it out and a need to work it out in order to move ahead. It's not just that Yavani is there and a stranger. He becomes part and parcel of this family, even though he's not in the middle of it. He becomes part of the family in his own way. And in fact, Maddie treats him as such in her own way.
We're going to come back and look at how these two worlds intersect, the black family in the Jim Crow South and the Jewish scholar doing more than passing through. In this case, in John Henry Redwood's No Niggers, No Jews, No Dogs. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I know it's my heart, darling, to see you drive me this way.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about John Henry Redwood's latest play, No Niggers, No Jews, No Dogs. It's a brutal title that tells a tough but ultimately very compassionate story of how the threads of a family and a man intertwine in the Jim Crow South. I'm joined in the studio tonight by the cast of the play as it will be performed, premiering tonight, opening tonight in New England at the New Repertory Theater in Newton, Massachusetts, by Adam Zoller, who's the producing associate and director of the New Rep, and from Norfolk, Virginia, by John Henry Redwood, the playwright. Adam Zoller, Yavani Aronson is woven throughout the play. He's in the region, in the family, as a researcher, but the story turns out to be much richer than that. Tell us about how this Jewish man intersects with the life of the Cheeks family as the play unfolds.
In terms of what's happened in the story, he's paying the money. He found them actually through Rawl's brother in Cleveland. He found out about them, and he's paying money to study them for a book that he's writing about the similarities in suffering between the Jewish people and the Negro people. So he has paid them to sit around and study them, and he comes by from time to time to take notes. And as this unfolds, he therefore is present after the rape has occurred, and he hears what's happening. And Maddie binds him to silence. Yet he still talks to her and argues with her about doing what's right. In terms of dramatically, what John Henry has set up for us is somebody who has a sensibility much like we would.
Saying, you've got to go to the authorities.
You've got to go to the authorities. Mm-hmm. Do what's right. And it's a modern sensibility that we very much understand. In fact, one of my designers, when she first read the play, said, well, I think he's right. She should go.
But in the meantime, he's drawn into the drama himself. In the nearby town, he's kind of pushed around. His yarmulke is torn off and cut up and stomped on in the town street.
Because they identify him as a Jew, and things have come to a pass in the town, and they're identifying strangers and identifying Jews. And this kind of thing happens all the time in the South. This happened to my father in the South in Louisiana in 1951. And with that, he's kind of drawn closer to the family because of that. And eventually it leads, he feels he has to, he's been told he has to leave the town. But before he leaves, he really feels that he needs to help the family, and particularly help Joyce, who's 17, to work through these things. And he starts to tell her about himself, about how he came from Russia when he was very young and settled in Cleveland, and eventually started to assimilate. And he fell in love and decided to change his name from Aronson to Arnold and become Gentile rather than become Jewish.
Ultimately married to an American woman of the South.
Of the South.
And there, within the context of that marriage, he's forced to confront some pretty tough stuff. Here's Ted Kazanoff with a monologue that he's delivering to the 17-year-old Joyce Cheeks.
Then I met Mildred. To me, there was none more beautiful, more pleasing to the eye. One day, Mildred told me she was going back to Mississippi, attend college in a hometown. I couldn't imagine the pain of life without her. And that's when I became Jack Arnold, goy, Gentile. I followed Mildred to Mississippi to attend college, really to be near her. Mildred and her older brother picked me up from the train station and drove me the rest of the way to their hometown. And as we approached the town limits, there was a big sign which read, "Welcome to the town of Holman in the great Magnolia State of Mississippi." A little further on down the road, a larger sign which read, "No niggers, no Jews, no dogs." There it was, in writing. Negroes and Jews together relegated to the same level as dogs. Oh, but I convinced myself it didn't refer to me, because I was a goy. And I was in a car with the most beautiful woman in the world, and I loved very much. And that was all that mattered.
There's reassurance from the visitor, and in this soliloquy, the title of the play comes through. At the top of the show, we took some literary license in describing a scene in North Carolina where such a sign might have stood, but in fact, John Henry Redwood, in your own history, it's when you were a university student in Kansas traveling in Mississippi in the 60s that such a sign came before your eyes and left a mark.
Yes, sir, it did. Mm-hmm. Well, let me put it this way. Jews were, to me, they were white people, but they practiced a different religion. It was just like anyone who might be, mm-hmm. like, I come from an African-American community, and they're Baptists, and they're African AMEs, and different type of religion. So I just thought of them as white people at that time, as just white people as with a different religion. And so this was the first time it was very shocking to me to find that they were being discriminated against as much as, if not more, than blacks in some cases.
Jacqueline Gregg, I want to put to you, you've got the toughest role in this play in some ways. Your character, Maddie, goes through the most. John Henry Redwood is drawing this equation. Adam Zoller has defined it, too, the similarity in suffering between blacks and Jews here. As you get into the weave of this play, does that come through to you as credible, as full, as similar?
Absolutely. Especially in Yevhenny's story. I mean, it's a very compelling story. And
all that was lost in Russia, his family
absolutely.
Ends up in Germany on its way.
At that point, she realizes also that he has been carrying this with him for all of his life, and his
yet to share it with someone, and he chose this time to share it with us. Also to help Maddie, to help Joyce understand mm-hmm. why she made the choices that she did.
To step up to that moment,
absolutely.
Not to run away for it, to engage with this family, and ultimately they drive north together.
Absolutely.
The time is too short, and we're out of it, but I want to thank you all so much for coming in and being with us tonight. First, to the cast, Baron Kelly, Ted Kazanoff, Giselle Jones, Natanja Driscoll, and Jacqueline Gregg. Thank you to each and every one of you for being with us. Adam Zoller, thanks for being with us in the studio, and good luck with the production at the New Repertory Theater. And John Henry Redwood in Norfolk, Virginia, thank you very much for joining us, and for the play, No Niggers, No Jews, No Dogs. Tough title, but we've got the story, and we thank you for it.
Thank you.
For more information on the current production of the play, or productions around the country, visit our website at onpointradio.org. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
A liberated Iraq can show the power of freedom to transform that vital region by bringing hope and progress into the lives of millions.
We're not looking for some votes here, some votes there. We want everybody to realize that the longer period of the same old pattern of inspectors not getting very far has got to stop, and we've got to move on.
We don't think that the chance for peaceful disarmament of Iraq has been lost or has been missed. We are convinced, on the contrary, that the inspections are proceeding effectively and that Iraq is responding to the demands of international community and to the pressure exerted on it.
I want to make sure that I understand, Mr. President. So you do not intend to destroy these missiles?
Yes, sir.
Which missiles are you talking about? We do not have missiles that go beyond the prescribed ranges by the UN.
Whatever you do in Iraq, it should not reduce your attention from Afghanistan. If you reduce attention because of Iraq to Afghanistan, and if we leave the whole thing to us to fight again, it will be repeating the mistakes that the United States made during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. Once the Soviets left, the Americans left.
It seems to be a fairly innocuous kind of test, a short-range surface-to-surface naval missile that goes at maybe 60 or so miles. From what I've been able to determine, it's a fairly old system. Why they chose to do it today, I will let you speculate as well as anyone else can.
We've got three shuttles left, and
it's a marvelous heavy lift capacity.
And it's a marvelous way of eating up tax dollars as well. If we rely on it for too long, we'll eat up the seed corn we need for investing in a new system.
The Libeskind plan succeeds both when it rises into the sky and when it descends into the ground. In doing so, it captures the soaring optimism of our city and honors the eternal spirit of our fallen heroes.
I'll be back when the week is new, and I'll have more ideas for you, and you'll have things you'll want to talk about. I will be back next time. Bye.
And there's a week. President Bush says the democratic Iraq will set an example for the entire Middle East. Britain's ambassador to the UN explains why the UK, the US, and Spain are introducing a new resolution that will say Iraq is in violation of requirements to disarm. Russia's ambassador, Sergei Lavrov, says weapons inspectors need to be given more time. Today, a Russian official said his country is prepared to veto any resolution that will authorize war. Saddam Hussein, in an interview with CBS's Dan Rather, continues to deny that Iraq has illegal weapons. In Washington, Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai pleads for the American government not to forget about his country. In Seoul, for the inauguration of South Korea's new president, Secretary of State Colin Powell downplays a North Korean missile test. NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe on the hot seat as the House Science Committee reviewed NASA's 2004 spending plan. A design is chosen for rebuilding the former World Trade Center site. The plan calls for construction of the world's tallest building. And television's Mr. Rogers passes away at the age of 74. Jack Beatty, a lot on the table this week.
Yes, and in some ways the most disturbing event of the week was the Saddam Hussein interview with Dan Rather, and the moment in that interview where he suggested that he and Mr. Bush should have a debate. And you realize suddenly, my God, this man is completely out of touch. And that's scary.
It's just such a mismatch. It's so absurd. He's playing to a crowd, and he must think that he feels that crowd around the world.
Well, I suppose, but he apparently spoke without irony, and it just makes me think that he is in Xanadu there, and no one is telling him what he needs to do, and that this thing is going to go to war because he's not going to blink, he's not going to do more than what he's done in terms of accounting for the shortfall in chemical and biological weapons.
Not a pretty Xanadu. The Bush administration also putting cards on the table this week.
Yes, this is the week where we had some candor from the Joint Chief of Staff member from the Army, who said that it may take several hundred thousand U.S. troops to occupy Iraq and to stay there for some time. He was corrected quickly by Paul Wolfowitz, saying, oh, no, nothing like that. And also this week, turns out Larry Lindsey, who was fired late last year for being candid about what a war would cost, wasn't so far off on his estimates. The administration people now are saying, well, yes, it might well cost $100 billion to fight the war, but we can't be sure, which was where Lindsey's estimate began. It went to $200 billion.
So big numbers put out and pulled back. Donald Rumsfeld called it several hundred thousand man estimate, wildly exaggerated.
Yes, well, we'll have to see. But I think that the Army general doesn't have a political agenda. And also the Bush administration exposed its maximalist aim. This war is not just about weapons of mass destruction. It's not just about removing Saddam Hussein. It's about revolutionizing the Middle East. It's about introducing democracy there. And it's this sort of ultimate aim that we have. And, of course, this is very sobering, I expect, to the rest of the world who thinks that's an impossible undertaking.
Well, I would love to have been a fly on the wall in Hamid Karzai's presidential suite in Washington this week where he was visiting. You could hear practically the fear in his voice pleading for Washington not to forget the Afghan piece of that fabric as they march on with democracy to the rest of the region, at least rhetorically.
Yes, and isn't it telling that the administration left out money from its budget for Afghan reconstruction? And it was only after Congress said, hey, wait a minute, you were supposed to have money in here to reconstruct Afghanistan, that they put it in. That's hardly a good augury for Iraq.
There's Hamid Karzai saying, please, please, please don't forget about us. It can slide back to where it was. Jack, have a great weekend. Thanks for being
and
with
you
us
too.
Tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Have a great weekend. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.